President Raisi, says Iran's membership in BRICS and regional alliances helps the country stand against unilateralism. A hunger strike by hundreds of Bahraini political prisoners over jail conditions enters its fourth week. And travel chaos continues in the UK after the country's air traffic control system suffers a technical failure. Welcome to World News, coming to you live from our international studios right here in Tehran. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. President Ebrahim Raisi says Iran's enemies have adopted the strategy of isolating the Islamic Republic, but Iran's current position on the global level shows they have failed in their attempts. Raisi was speaking with reporters in Tehran on the occasion of Government Week. He said the enemies wanted to disappoint the Iranian people and resorted to riots last year when they realized that the country is on the path of development. Raisi added that Iran's adversaries pinned their hopes to those riots and left the negotiating table. But when the country managed to contain the riots, they sent messages to come back to the talks. The Iranian president said his government is open to talks, but has not tied up the country's fate to the will of some Western states.
Iran has not tied its economy to the will of some Western states. We are following the issue of the removal of sanctions through negotiations, but we are not waiting for them to make decisions about our country.
Raisi said Western parties to the 2015 deal or the JCPOA failed to comply with their commitments. That was why efforts to revive the deal failed. The president added that some countries are using the deal as a lever to pressure Iran. He noted the Iranian nation has turned the sanctions and threats into opportunities. The Islamic Republic has proved to have unique economic capacities, which it has tapped into in its relations with Latin America and Africa. Raisi stressed that Iran's membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS can help it stand against Western unilateralism. He also criticized the desecration of Muslim sanctities and its insults to entire humanity. Our correspondent Gisu Misha Ahmadi has been at the press conference of the president. She spoke with us about other issues he raised in his presser. They included expanding relations with regional and Islamic countries.
We saw at the beginning of the press conference, basically, most questions were directed to the issue of Iran joining BRICS and, of course, the SCO and how this could affect Iran's economy and the fact that Iran has been able to overcome sanctions and is no longer an isolated country. So aside from the domestic issues that were brought up during the press conference, basically what could be mentioned as the most important talk of the day was the fact that Iran is on the right path to expand its foreign relations with different countries. As far as President Ebrahim Raisi is concerned, he said that, as mentioned many times before, and in over 10 different occasions where President Ebrahim Raisi has had a chance to express his goals as he has been traveling to different countries across the world, the fact that Iran is adamant to expand its foreign relations with countries based on mutual understanding, based on an equal ground, and of course national interests pertaining to both countries.
Bahraini authorities have conceded to offer more rights to political prisoners as hundreds strong hunger strikers over the country's inhumane jail conditions enters its fourth week. The Interior Ministry announced a proposal which includes extended visiting hours and extra time outdoors. This has failed to quell what is believed to be the biggest hunger strike in Bahrain's history. Rights groups stress that the strike will continue until the government addresses the inmates' concerns seriously and in good faith. Over 800 prisoners of conscience went on hunger strike in Bahrain earlier this month. They have several grievances, including a ban on worshiping and a lack of adequate health care. The strike triggered nationwide protests with thousands of Bahrainis taking to the streets in solidarity with the prisoners. Meantime, Bahraini media has raised the alarm over the critical deterioration of the health conditions of several inmates in the notorious Jauf prison. Now to Syria, where the army there has targeted the bases of two terrorist groups on the outskirts of Idlib in the northwestern part of the country. According to the Defense Ministry, bomb and missile attacks hit the positions of two terror groups, including Al-Qaeda linked Tahrir al-Sham. The ministry says a large number of terrorists, among them their leaders, were killed as a result. Their arms and ammunition were destroyed as well. Syria says Russian warplanes cooperated in the operation. It also says the operation followed recent attacks by the terrorists against Syrian military bases near the cities of Hama and Idlib. Syria and its allied resistance forces largely contain the terrorist groups, including Daesh, operating in that country. However, remnants of the groups are still active in some parts. Earlier, we were joined by the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, Tim Anderson. He refers to a series of events in Syria and explains how foreign elements are involved in them.
There's an incredible economic hardship in Syria because of the blockade, and there have been protests because of the removal of subsidies. So there's really a return to some protests over the standard of living there, and they've been politicized by some factions. At the same time, as you say, there's a coordinated attack from the northwest part of Idlib by the al-Qaeda groups, the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which are backed by the US and others, and also an increased activity by Daesh in the eastern part, and they have really been found safe haven in the area occupied by the US military and its Qasad or Kurdish militia, basically. So they've held them and they've released them at time for certain functions. At the same time, the US military itself has increased its presence, and they vowed they want to try and control the entire Syrian-Iraqi border. Well, those who followed this would know that the one crossing the resistance, that is to say Iran, Iraq, Hashid al-Shabi, and Syria control, is the Abu Kamal crossing in the southeast there, and that was liberated by forces led by General Qasem Soleimani in late 2017. Now, at the same time, when there's a bit of a promise of some increased Arab investment, a group of Arab investors arrived in Aleppo recently, and very soon after, the Israelis launched long-range missile attacks on Aleppo airport. So all these things happening together, and it's not a coincidence. There's quite a degree of coordination. There always has been, but there's several matters coming together at the moment, and it seems to be a renewed push by the US to mobilize its fake Syrian revolution at a time when they're losing on many other fronts, and of course they're facing an election year coming up too.
The Islamabad High Court has suspended Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan's recent conviction on corruption charges. Khan's lawyer says he has been granted bail after they file an appeal against the conviction. Well, the lawyer says that they have also filed another application to prevent Khan's re-arrest. That's because they fear authorities may arrest him again. Khan was sentenced to 3 years in prison earlier this month for selling state gifts during his tenure as prime minister. Because of the conviction, Pakistan's Election Commission has also barred Khan from contesting elections for 5 years. Now, the former premier has dismissed the accusations as being politically motivated. Nasser Kazmi says it's unlikely for Imran Khan to run in Pakistan's upcoming general elections.
More than 100 cases which Khan is facing at the moment, most of them are criminal cases. So saying this, that he would be able to take part in the elections, it would be too early to say, because the Election Commission of Pakistan has barred former premier to take part in the politics for the next 5 years. So the elections which are going to be held in November this year is most likely that Mr. Khan would not be able to contest those elections. His opponents, the party of the former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, especially, they have criticized the judiciary about these types of verdicts, and in which he alleged the top judge of the Supreme Court that he is a biased judge, and he is supporting Mr. Khan in these cases.
Now to the UK, where travel chaos continues after the country's air traffic control system suffered a technical failure. Britain's National Air Traffic Services said it has identified and remedied the issue. It, however, warned that the ensuing disruption could last further into the week. The technical meltdown left hundreds of thousands of passengers stranded or delayed on the summer bank holiday. More than 500 flights to and from the UK were canceled. Earlier, the Air Traffic Control Agency had to restrict the flow of aircrafts when its automatic processing of flight plans malfunctioned. It required them to be handled manually. Now crossing over to France, where nearly 2,000 people have been convicted over the nationwide protests sparked in late June by the police's fatal shooting of a teenager. That's according to France's Justice Minister, Eric Dupond-Moretti, who has called for a rapid, firm, and systematic response from magistrates to those described as rioters. Many courts are now holding fast-track trials for the suspects. The minister says it's the question of restoring law and order. The protests began after police officers shot dead a 17-year-old boy with North African roots during a traffic stop west of Paris. France deployed around 45,000 security forces for several days to contain the protests. Well, the 2022 EU law on digital services came into effect a few days ago, raising concerns over its potential implications. Many in Italy fear the new provision will limit individuals' freedom of speech. Max Civilli reports.
Market and consumer protection. And Mr.
It has been named Digital Services Act, or DSA, and it is the European Union new law designed to tackle hate speech and fake news online. But it is much more than that. The DSA, which came into effect on August 25, stipulates that online platforms with more than 45 million monthly active users will have to take off illegal content, hate speech, and so-called disinformation from their platforms, or they will face fines of up to 6% of their annual global turnover.
As it occurs for many other EU laws, the DSA's real objectives seem to be hidden. While it is clear that the risk the EU could abuse this mechanism is worrying indeed. My concern is that people's rights that have been so far protected by our constitution may be circumvented by lackluster provisions.
More than 40 online giants, including Google, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, must now comply with the new legislation, which will force them to be legally accountable for everything from fake news to manipulation of shoppers, government's propaganda, and criminal activity, including child abuse. But a question remains open. Who decides what counts as real or fake news? And who decides what is and is not disinformation?
This is the real issue. Who decides what disinformation is? According to the ACT, this decision will be made arbitrarily by some EU officials with the help of trusted flaggers, bodies of people entitled to tip the authorities off. Which bodies? Which people? In my view, this whole legislation was designed to contain growing dissent in the EU.
Many in Italy, including some political organizations, newspapers and individuals, have expressed deep concerns over the DSA. Even the head of the League's delegation to the EU Parliament, Marco Campomenosi, has warned the DSA is likely to strengthen censorship on the internet. The League is one of Italy's coalition government parties. On the heels of the DSA, also a new European Digital Markets Act has recently come into effect. The provision is designed to regulate competition between large and smaller companies. Tech giants, for instance, will no longer be allowed to rank their own products or services higher than those of their competitors for the sake of consumers or end users, the EU says. The regulation of the Digital Services Act will be overseen by the European Commission itself, not by an independent regulator. The implications for freedom of expression are obvious and ominous. Max Civili, Rome.
Well, Russia says its air defenses have destroyed several Ukrainian drones flying over the country. According to the Defense Ministry, two drones were shot down over the Tula region south of the capital, Moscow. Air defenses also downed another drone in the Belgorod region on the border with Ukraine. No damage or casualties have been reported so far. Meanwhile, Ukraine says its troops have further advanced in the southern Zaporizhzhia front. This comes a day after Ukraine's military confirmed the capture of a key village in that region. Every August, the people of Afghanistan are reminded of many painful events, the memories of children being killed by American drones and people falling from American planes have left an indelible mark on the hearts and minds of the Afghan people. More in the following report.
On August 29, 2021, as the U.S. was withdrawing its forces tumultuously, their drones were flying over Kabul to maintain security. A car suspected of carrying bombs was placed under surveillance. After a tiring day, Zumaray, the owner of the car, returned home to find peace with his family. As he parked the car in the yard and his children rushed to greet him, the man behind the joystick and his superiors made the fateful decision that this was the best time to act. Zumaray and nine members of his family were tragically killed in the airstrike carried out by American forces on that day. Seven of the victims were innocent children under the age of 12. The youngest was only 2 years old. Zumaray himself was a relief worker who had spent the last day of his life distributing food among needy people in Kabul. During the U.S. withdrawal, which took almost 2 weeks, Afghan people witnessed countless brutalities and painful events. Ruhullah and Ahmad say that the bitter memories of those days will remain with them forever, etched in their minds as a reminder of the suffering they endured.
I remember the chaos those days, the explosion near the airport and the drone attack on that car were heartbreaking. This is what we saw during the entire presence of the U.S. here, death and destruction, but no benefit.
The innocent children that did not know anything about policy, didn't know anything about government, didn't know anything about life, but they are being killed, and it's really mournful for me and also for all citizens of Afghanistan.
Back the fuck up!
During the 15-day pullout of U.S. forces, many people were killed either directly by the Americans or indirectly through their negligence. Some by falling off American planes, many in a suicide attack near the Kabul airport, and some by American missiles inside their own home. Most experts believe that the U.S. is to blame for these lost lives.
As the U.S. was withdrawn, they intentionally made a false announcement claiming that they would take as many Afghans abroad as possible. This caused many people to rush to the airport in hopes of being taken to safety. The U.S. had several motives for this action, but the most important one was to show the world that the people of Afghanistan wanted them here in an attempt to justify their 20-year presence in the country. However, chaos quickly spiraled out of control, resulting in the tragic loss of many lives.
A day after the airstrike, the Pentagon spokesperson said that the civilians were probably killed by a second explosion, but experts proved that there was only one explosion from the missile. American authorities simply got over with the case by saying it was a mistake and that they were sorry, yet no one was fired or even demoted. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
And with that brings us to the end of this Worldness edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The BRICS combined GDP already exceeds that of the G7, and the gap will widen further once six new members join next year. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT wrote, the addition of six new member states will propel the BRICS group of countries far ahead of its major rival, the G7, in economic terms. Several Russian media outlets reported recently citing calculations based on global data. BRICS currently consists of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, but next January it will admit Iran, Argentina, Egypt, Ethiopia, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. According to reports from the news outlets RBK and TASS, the combined gross domestic product GDP of the expanded BRICS in terms of purchasing power parity, that is PPP, will be roughly $65 trillion. This would see the bloc's share of global GDP rise from the current 31.5% to 37%. In comparison, the share of the G7 group of advanced economies is currently around 29.9%. Furthermore, with the addition of the new members, BRICS nations will account for almost half of the world's food production. In 2021, the group's wheat harvest amounted to 49% of the globe's total. The share of the G7 was 19.1%. BRICS will also have an advantage in terms of the production of metals used in the high-tech industry. The 11 nations will account for 79% of global aluminum output against just 1.3% controlled by the G7. For palladium, the disparity is 77% for BRICS versus 6.9% for the G7. The expanded BRICS will account for roughly 38.3% of the globe's industrial production versus 30.5% for the G7. However, the latter will retain the advantage in terms of exports, with a share of 28.8% against 23.4% for BRICS. Saudi Arabia has the largest economy among the new BRICS member states. Its GDP in dollar terms at the end of 2022 was estimated at $1.1 trillion. Meanwhile, the UAE will be a formidable addition to the bloc thanks to its status as a major exporter. Its exports of goods in 2022 amounted to nearly $600 billion. Overall, the 11 BRICS countries will account for 48.5 million square kilometers, representing 36% of the world's land area. This is more than double that of the G7. The combined population will amount to 3.6 billion, 45% of the globe's total, and more than four times above the G7. NBC News also noted, as China and Russia work to curtail American and Western influence on the global stage, the bloc of developing countries, known as BRICS, is debating a major expansion to increase its power and diminish the dominance of the U.S. dollar. Already, the five members of BRICS collectively make up some 40% of the global population and more than 30% of the global economy, according to the International Monetary Fund. As it fashions itself into an alternative to the U.S.-dominated G7 and other Western-led international groupings, BRICS has become a major platform for developing nations in the global South that have long complained they have been left behind. Aiming to expand their economic options, BRICS members have also discussed creating a currency that could offer an alternative to the U.S. dollar for global trade, a push known as de-dollarization. According to Tasnim News Agency, the BRICS consortium is set to reshape the global energy landscape as per calculations based on 2022 OPEC data on oil production and exports, reported InfoTech news outlets recently. According to these computations, the group's projected expansion involving the addition of six new members will grant it dominion over nearly half of the world's oil reserves and production. Currently comprised of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, BRICS announced at the Johannesburg summit that Iran, Argentina, Egypt, Ethiopia, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE will officially join in January 2024. With the inclusion of Iran, Saudi Arabia, UAE, the group will significantly increase its weight in the oil market. Together with current members, Russia and Brazil, these nations collectively control 39% of the world's total oil exports, equivalent to 17.1 million barrels per day. After expansion, the 11 nations in BRICS will account for approximately 47.6% of the world's total oil production, according to the data. Regarding oil reserves, BRICS will also possess nearly half of the world's total, amounting to 719.5 billion barrels out of 1.6 trillion. If Venezuela, which has applied for membership, is accepted, the group's control will increase to around 65.4%. In comparison, the G7 leading economies, including the US, the UK, Germany, Italy, Canada, France, and Japan, control only 3.9% of known crude reserves. Analysts anticipate that BRICS expansion to include Persian Gulf countries will likely diminish U.S. influence in the global oil market. Irish economist Philip Plington, in an article for the British Portrait Unheard, said Saudi Arabia and the UAE joining is extremely significant. The United States used to rely on the Persian Gulf monarchies, especially Saudi Arabia, to exert control over the oil price. With their accession to BRICS, it seems likely that America has lost any control it had over oil prices for the foreseeable future. Pillington also noted that the recent BRICS summit signifies the end of Iran's economic isolation. Given Iran's status as the world's eighth largest oil producer with the third largest proven oil reserves.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now let's listen to the speech of Sheikh Jafar Jafar.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. A person by the name of Dawood al-Raqqi, he says, I was with our sixth Imam alayhi salam, إِذَا اسْتَسْقَ الْمَاءِ, as water was poured for him. فَلَمَّا شَرِبَهُ رَأَيْتُهُ قَدِ اسْتَعْبَرَ أَيْنَاهُ, that when he drank water, I saw that his eyes welled up with tears. And so he said, ثُمَّ قَالَ يَا دَاوُودِ لَعَنَ اللَّهُ قَاتِلَ الْحُسَيْنِ, that may the condemnation of God, the removal of mercy of God be upon those who killed Imam al-Husayn. وَمَا مِنْ عَبْدٍ شَرِبَ الْمَاءِ فَذَكَرَ الْحُسَيْنِ وَأَهْلَ بَيْتِهِ وَلَعَنَ قَاتِلَهُ إِلَّا كَتَبَ اللَّهُ عَزَّ وَجَلَّ 100,000 حَسَنًا وَحَتَّ عَنْهُ 100,000 سَيِّئًا. Yeah? That one who drinks water and remembers Imam Hussein, sends condemnation on the killers of Hussein, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will write for them 1,000 hasanat and excuse 1,000 sayyiat. Again, not arbitrary. Right? I think sometimes when we read these hadiths, other people read this hadith, they say like this sounds a bit like exaggeration. But we're talking here that these remembrances, man, should be an impetus of a change of lifestyle. This is why this azadari is so important, my brothers and sisters. Because it's not just a cultural exercise. It's not just a religious tick box. But it's something that should generate reform in each of our lives. And so why is there such emphasis on these tears, right? There's so much emphasis, again, like we quoted just two hadith, but the emphasis was on trying to shed tears, yeah? To try to shed a tear for what happened in Karbala. Why such benefit? I'll mention five very quickly. The last one is where I do want to focus on. Number one, because shedding tears is a sign of a mu'min. Understand this. Yeah. Again, traditions say this is from our third Imam Aba Abdullah Al Hussein alayhi salam. Allahumma salli ala wa ali Muhammad, where he says, "Ana qatilul abra." Yeah. You know, qatilul abra. There's two meanings to it, but the Imam gives us the first meaning. He says, "I am the one, the qatil, the one who was killed." And abra is tears. I am the qatil of abra. I am the shaheed of tears. And what does that mean? He says, لا يذكرني مؤمن إلا استعبرا. That I will not be mentioned in front of a believer except that they will cry for me. Yeah? It's a sign of iman. Yeah? Again, this azadari is by God a theological matter. Yeah? It is an aqidi matter. It is not something cultural. It is not something furu'i. It is usuli. Yeah? That we gather in these ways. And hence it is a sign of a mu'min that they will weep. And so this is something you and I should try to be like. When we look at signs of believers, that's what we should aim for, isn't it? Because at the end of the day, it's their criteria that matters. It's not my criteria of what a mu'min is that matters. So number one, it is a sign of a believer. Number two, we are following the sunnah of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Ma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. His daughter Zahra and all of the a'imma alayhim salam, because they all shed tears for Hussein. Yeah? And so this is sunnatu Rasulullah. Yeah? This is sunnatu Fatimah al-Zahra, sunnatu Ali, sunnatu al-Hassan, and sunnatu of all the a'imma, that they shed tears. And us who are the sunnah, following the sunnah, It is our responsibility to shed tears as well, because that's what they taught us, isn't it? Right? And so we follow their example and we follow their teachings, and so it is part of their sunnah, and hence we follow that sunnah. So that's the second reason. Number three, it is a demonstration of our connection to the Imam alayhi salam. Yeah? That how can we understand the maqam, yeah, of the Imam and not shed a tear for the Imam? Right? And so it is our way of displaying connection. And you know, a dua we should make, that when a tear does come out, and it's an authentic tear, and they are authentic tears, you know, that say at that time, Ya Laytana Kunna Ma'ak. Say it. Because you know, there are other times when we say, Ya Laytana Kunna Ma'ak, that, oh, I wish we were with you. When it's just lip service. Yeah? But there are times when it's very authentic. And that authentic time is when we actually feel that pain in our hearts. Right? That's the time we should say it. Yeah, that's the time, make this dua, because I think at that time it has a powerful effect on us. So that's number three. Number four, the fourth reason why we shed tears is because it keeps the message and teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alive. Yeah? Understand this. I'll quote this hadith. This is what I mentioned in the beginning, that these majalis are part of our legacy. It's part of our religious foundation. This hadith that we have is quoted by our sixth Imam, As-Sadiq alayhi salam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. He says to his companion Fudail, he says, Ya Fudail, tajlisuna wa tuhaddithun. He says, do you gather, do you sit, and do you discuss? Yeah? Yani this is majlis. Yeah? Tuhaddithuna wa tajlisun. Tajlisuna wa tuhaddithun. This julus is what we are doing here today. And he says, Naam, ju'iltu fidak. He says, yes, we do, and may we be sacrificed for you, right? He says, Inna tilkal majalis uhibbuha fa'ahyu amrana. He says that these majalis, these gatherings are loved by us. Yeah? And it allows for our amr, our affairs, our orders, yeah, our rights to be continued, to be hayat, to be alive. And then the Imam alayhi salam says, فَرَّحِمَ اللَّهُ مَنْ أَحْيَى أَمْرَنَا. He says, may Allah bless, Allah will be full of mercy for the one who keeps alive our dhikr, yeah? Who keeps alive our remembrance. By God, this is it, yeah? This is an example of it. This is not it, but this is an example of it. But the Imam continues. He says, Ya Fudail, man dhakarana aw dhukirna indahu. He says that when we are mentioned by someone or we are mentioned in that person's presence, yani someone's talking and we are listening or we are talking about them, he says, فَخَرَجَ مِنْ عَيْنِهِ مِثْلُ جَنَاحِ الذُّبَابِ. And then again, a tear the size of a wing of an angel comes out. غَفَرَ اللَّهُ لَهُ ذُنُوبُهُ وَلَوْ كَانَتْ أَكْثَرَ مِنْ زَبَدِ الْبَحَرِ. He says that Allah would forgive their past sins because of that, even though they may be the size of oceans. Now why? Again, why? Because if we truly, again, man, I have to emphasize this, because sometimes we take these things for granted. If we truly gather and remember them and learn from them, then I wouldn't sin again. You understand? Yeah? And if I wouldn't sin again, then why would God not forgive me when Allah has promised that Allahu yaghfiru dhunuba jami'a? That Allah can wipe away all of your sins. It's not a big deal for God. All God wants to see is reformation, change, islah. Right? And so this is something that when we gather with these type of gatherings, man, again, we should have that intention that I'm going to take away one thing, two things to improve my life, better my life, so that I don't be the same person that I was.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حالي حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم
وصلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak faces a fresh conflict of interest row over trade talks between London and New Delhi. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Observer has covered this story. With a general election not far away and the economy still struggling, Rishi Sunak is on the hunt for good news. Next month, he will be in New Delhi, India for the G20 summit, a visit that will be unusually rich with picture opportunities and chances to strike deals. Sunak's parents are of Indian Punjabi descent, and his wife, Akshata Murthy, is a hugely wealthy Indian businesswoman, fashion designer and venture capitalist. In many ways, it will be a homecoming for the first Asian couple ever to occupy No. 10 Downing Street. Sunak's business and trade secretary, Kemi Badenoch, has been in India over the past few days, laying the ground for a string of announcements with her G20 counterparts. Inevitably, much of the talk in the United Kingdom and Indian diplomatic, business and trade circles has been about the possibility of a post-Brexit trade deal between the United Kingdom and India. The two governments had hoped to conclude one last autumn, but negotiations have dragged on. Agreement between the world's fifth and sixth biggest economies, India and the UK respectively, to reduce tariffs on UK exports such as cars and increase still further access for Indian workers to the United Kingdom would be a big deal for Prime Minister Sunak. But there are issues worrying Downing Street. India already tops the list of nations sending citizens to the United Kingdom. Between June of last year and June of this year, the number of Indian healthcare workers entering the United Kingdom leapt by 81%. From 18,570 to 33,669. Indians also topped other categories. While Brexiters in Sunak's party desperately want evidence that global Britain is real, they may not be thrilled to see that the flip side of liberated post-European Union trading arrangements means replacing EU workers with others from further afield. There is, though, another fear nagging away inside Number 10 and a Foreign Office. In return for lowering tariffs on British exports to Indian markets, New Delhi is asking for more visas for skilled workers such as IT professionals who work for Indian technology companies that have invested in Britain. India also wants improved access for young Indians to the United Kingdom. One of the main companies with an interest in securing more temporary visas to the United Kingdom is Infosys, the huge global leader in digital services and consulting co-founded by Akshata Murthy's father, N.R. Narayana Murthy. Although Akshata has only a 0.93% holding in the company, it's still worth £481 million and accounted for the vast majority of the Sunak family's wealth when the Sunday Times published its 2023 Rich List in May. Shivendra Singh, Vice President and Head of Global Trade at NASSCOM, the IT industry body, said new age technologies such as generative artificial intelligence, blockchain and machine learning have widened the demand-supply gap. We want to make it easier for IT workers to go to Britain to fill the gap on projects and then come back. They will go and return. This does not affect net migration at all. Infosys applied for 2,500 visas for the UK in 2019, primarily so that it could bring its staff to work on large outsourced IT contracts in the country. Being such a large enterprise, the company has the ear of the Indian government. The problem for Prime Minister Sunak is that a UK-India trade deal, if struck, is likely to be of considerable financial benefit to the company in which his own wife already has a very large financial stake. Questions about a conflict of interest are already being asked. What should the Sunaks do? That is what Number 10 has worried about for some time, according to one source aware of thinking at the top of government on this issue. There's a lot of concern about perception and what it would look like to people, a worry that one day someone will eventually join the dots. Indian website The Wire has also covered the same story. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak may be facing more troubles over his wife's connection with IT giant Infosys, with calls for transparency over his interests as the free trade deal with India looks at increasing visas for Indian workers, according to the British newspaper The Observer, reporting on Saturday, 26th of August. Rishi Sunak faces a new conflict of interest row before a G20 summit in New Delhi next month over claims that his family could stand to benefit financially from a post-Brexit trade deal that he's negotiating with India. Lawmakers and trade experts say there are concerns at the highest levels of government over potential transparency issues relating to his wife, Akshata Murthy's shareholding in Infosys. Akshata Murthy is the daughter of one of Infosys's founders, Narayana Murthy. The opposition head of the Parliamentary Select Committee on Business and Trade, Darren Jones, told The Observer that it was important for the Prime Minister to declare his interests. Darren Jones said, "I expect him to do so in respect of the India trade deal as well." The Shadow Trade Secretary, Nick Thomas-Symonds, said his party backed the trade deal with India, so it is important that Prime Minister Sunak is transparent about any relevant business links and his personal role in negotiations. In a statement to The Observer, a British government spokesperson said that the Prime Minister was pursuing a trade deal with India in the best interests of the United Kingdom. The Prime Minister's interests have been declared in accordance with the normal processes. The latest accusation follows last week's announcement that the British Parliament's standards watchdog had concluded that Sunak had breached the code of conduct, albeit unintentionally. he was admonished for failing to properly declare his wife's shareholdings in a childcare company that stood to benefit from new government policies. Akshata Murthy was at the centre of another controversy last year due to her non-domicile status in Britain, which excludes her from paying British taxes on overseas income. She subsequently consented to pay taxes on her foreign earnings going forward. The British Prime Minister will be travelling to New Delhi to attend the G20 summit next month, where he is expected to discuss the free trade deal talks in a bilateral meeting with the host, Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The aftermath of Brexit prompted Britain to pursue new global trade relationships, and a significant focus was directed towards forging a comprehensive trade pact with India. A crucial requirement put forth by India during the negotiations for a free trade agreement is the expansion of visas granted to its workforce in sectors like information technology and artificial intelligence.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on August 6, 2023, with a meeting with the commander's crew and families of the 86th flotilla of the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy. Security for shipping and maritime transport must be ensured for all countries. Today, the U.S. attacks all tankers and helps maritime smugglers. What they are doing is a major violation. They do this in our region, and we are aware that they are doing this more or less in other places as well. These are violations of an international human law that cannot be disregarded. You practically implemented this law of public safety on the sea for everyone. This is another lesson. A conclusion can be made from all the lessons I have mentioned and from all the things I have said about the endeavor, and that is that we should all know that human success, great achievements, diverse developments, and fulfilled hopes are all the result of efforts and enduring hardships. Nothing is gained by seeking one's own comfort, by sitting in a corner, by just watching things, by regretting, by sighing, or by complaining. You must endure hardships.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You need to struggle and work hard in order to succeed. It is not enough to look at the peak of the mountain that someone else has climbed and say, I want to be there as well. If you want to get there, you need to endure the discomfort of moving on this path, or you won't get there. You have proven this. This is another important lesson. Now I would like to mention two other brief points at the end of my speech. One point is that the story of your 8-month journey can be a source for a good television or movie project. Artists need to come forward. What happened to you during this period is not something that can fit in a report of a few pages or in a speech of a few minutes. Every detail of what you experienced needs to be noted. There were 350 of you. Each of you had feelings, did things, had certain thoughts, did certain things, and experienced moments of happiness and moments of sadness. All of these things together can form a long, informative, meaningful story. This story can be presented in artistic form, in a cinematic or televised form. It is up to the artist to do this. The final point, which concerns the country's officials, is paying attention to the sea. We are still not paying enough attention to the sea.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.